sorry. Today is June 19th, 2015. I'm here at Brandon University with Mr. Brent Campbell, conducting an interview for the class, Advanced Topics in Oral History, for the project, Music and the Brandon Community. So Mr. Campbell, before we begin, you've read over the consent form, and do you have any concerns or questions about that?
No, I've read it over and I have no questions and no concerns.
Okay, that's good. So, unfortunately, I didn't record properly, so this is our second take on the introduction, but would you please introduce yourself again?
My name is Brent Campbell. I'm 56 years old. I live in Brandon, and I am just finishing my career as a high school band teacher.
Okay. So whereabouts are you from originally?
I was born in Edmonton. Lived there for a year. Then we moved to Winnipeg, lived there through first grade, and then my family moved to Toronto and I lived there through high school. Okay. My mother and father are still alive. My mother is 85. My father is just turning 84. My mother is from a small town just west of here called Elkhorn. She grew up there. And my father is from Brandon, so I do have some family history and ties to this area.
Okay.
I have three brothers, two older brothers, and one younger brother. And both of my older brothers live east. One is in Waterloo and one is in Toronto. And my younger brother lives here in Brandon with his family.
Okay. All right. So growing up, was music ever anything that was a big part of your family's life? Or?
Well, we always had the radio on. I can always remember my dad always had CBC on.
Okay.
And so we would, whenever we were in the car or anywhere, it was always CBC. So I grew up kind of listening to CBC and that influence. Other than that, yeah, music was a big part of my life growing up, too. I was always involved in the music, piano lessons, and then played in junior high, the band program in high school. I always, when I was in high school, I played several different instruments. I played trombone, euphonium, tenor saxophone, trumpet.
Okay.
In the school program, just whatever they needed. And I would always, growing up in Toronto, I just was drawn to jazz. I can remember Phil Nimmons, his band, Nimmons and 9 Plus 6, would come to our school as kind of an outreach program. They would travel around and they would perform, and I was always interested in that and loved hearing them play. And I can remember going downtown, I would just take the subway downtown and go and listen to jazz. I would go down into Yorkville and listen to small groups. I'd go down and listen to the Boss Brass play if they were playing at some of the clubs that are no longer in existence now. And it was a rich environment. I also played, when I was in high school, I played with the 48th Highlanders military band.
Okay.
And we would do a lot of parades and like big high-profile parades. We played Canada Day down at City Hall. We played the CNE, and it was just fun.
Oh, right on. So was it, with jazz, was this kind of a love at first sight sort of deal, or was it something they kind of grew into?
I think it's just something I kind of grew into, but I always liked listening to jazz. Like, I never liked listening to rock and roll that the other kids were listening to. A funny story I tell is that when I was in high school, at our high school dances, mm-hmm. we would have groups like April Wine, BTO, and then one year, I think I was in grade 9 or maybe grade 10, Rush played our high school dance.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't go to it because I wasn't into that kind of music. So,
yeah, I actually remember hearing a story. A friend of mine, his aunt, I think she was in the same high school as the Rush members, and apparently they played a school dance, and she just absolutely hated it because they wanted to dance, and that's not their sort of music. So,
yeah.
Interesting little tidbits there. So you mentioned like going to a lot of different venues in Toronto and everything. So jazz was pretty accessible.
Oh yeah, we could. I heard some really big time players in Toronto, like the Ellington Band and Sarah Vaughan and Earl Hines and all the great players with the Boss Brass and stuff. So Mo Kaufman, we'd go down to George's Spaghetti House and listen to Mo Kaufman and Ed Bicker play and Don Thompson, and so. It was high caliber stuff that I was listening to.
Okay. And you probably had a lot of records and tapes and all that.
Yeah, I did. Okay. I did. But I listened to a lot of radio too, and you know, back then you could hear a lot of eclectic stuff on CBC, but you could hear a lot of jazz too.
Okay, that's good. And so, and you mentioned that you performed quite a bit as well. So you mentioned the military band. So how did you come into that?
One of the kids at school, one of the older kids, it was a couple of grades ahead of me, was playing in this band, a military band. And just through hanging out with him, he says, why don't you come out and play? So I did. I went out and I actually auditioned for another military band. I forget what it was called. The Horse Guards. I can't remember. But the guy that ran it was kind of an older, crusty guy, and he didn't want to let me in. So then I went to the 48th Islanders, and I said, sure, come on in. And right from the get-go, I just played with them. And I would go down every week. We'd go down and have rehearsal, and it was great. It was just a lot of fun. And then during that time, I got hooked up with another, just a community jazz band that was based out of Brampton, actually. So it was a 45-minute drive across the top of the city. But
okay.
I would go with another guy, and I started playing with them too. And I was just always involved in doing stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. So when you're performing, like, did you do a lot of touring around Toronto, or like just kind of like the greater metropolis area? Or?
Yeah, just around the GTA area. Parades downtown, CNE, Ontario Place. With the jazz band, we would do different functions, but it's really around Toronto or real close to Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it wasn't a whole lot of heavy touring or anything like that?
Oh, no. No, I was not in any kind of a touring band at all.
Okay.
No.
Right. So when you graduated high school, I guess it was a pretty easy jump for you to decide to go into music for university?
Yeah, it was. There was, like, I always liked math and science, physics and math, but I never really felt a need or an urge to go into the sciences. I always just kind of thought, oh yeah, I like music, I'm going to probably go into music. Mm-hmm. And one of the other groups that I played in when I was there in Scarborough, we had this Scarborough Youth Orchestra that was started by a guy named Don Coakley, who was is actually a pretty well-known Canadian composer.
Okay.
And he was the assistant director of music for the Scarborough Board of Education, which was a lot of high schools, a lot of schools. And every June they would rent out this big camp up near Parry Sound called Manitowabi. And they would take, I don't know, 300-400 kids up there and run a music camp for a week.
Oh, wow.
And Don Coakley would always bring up people from the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, and he would bring up a lot of the people that he knew, colleagues of his from the U.S., from all over the U.S., but he would especially bring up people from his alma mater, which was the Crane School of Music in Potsdam, okay. Part of the State University of New York. Mm. And I just got to talk to some of the people that were teaching there and would come up to camp. And it's not that far from Toronto. It's maybe 4.5 hours drive.
Okay.
And they just said, encouraged me to come and try out and audition there. So I did. I went I auditioned there. I auditioned at U of T and at Western, and I got accepted into the two Canadian universities, but I was on the waiting list in New York.
Oh, okay.
And then I got a phone call. One of the guys, because they would let in like 5 trombone players every year, and one of the kids that they had accepted went somewhere else, and so then I was bumped up and I got into the Crane School of Music, and it's a small town. It's maybe 10,000.
Okay.
But a great music school. They're very highly regarded.
Okay.
And so I went there.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So how long the program was that?
That was 4 years. 4 years I came out with a Bachelor of Music Education.
Okay.
Which is different from here, where you get your music degree and then you would go and get your ed degree.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, it's all in one program. So 4 years, Bachelor of Music Education.
Okay.
So, and that's what I did.
All right. So what was it that led you into the teaching avenue?
Well, that's what my degree was in teaching. So I just always thought, oh, I'll get a job being a band teacher. But it's a funny thing, because down there, they also had a campus in the foothills of the Adirondacks called Star Lake, and you could go and do like you had to have so many phys ed credits to graduate. So you could go to this campus, it was like just going to a camp here, and you could go to the campus and you could take a weekend course and get a phys ed credit.
Okay.
And they had a lodge and a kitchen and lots of facilities and outdoor ed equipment. So I went down there and took a course, and then I got to know some of the people that were working there, and I started teaching down there because I had always been interested in the outdoors and doing canoe trips and camping and downhill skiing. And so I said, oh, I could teach that course for you. So I just kind of started working down there. And that's really how I put myself through university, was teaching on the weekends at this campus.
Okay.
I would teach canoeing, I would teach winter survival, downhill skiing, backpacking, snow shelters, stuff like this. And so that's what I did. And then I worked there for 2 summers. My last 2 years of university, I worked there in the summers for a program called Youth Conservation Corps.
Okay.
Which is a government program where they take kids from all over the state, inner city kids, rural kids, put them together in this program, and you basically go out and do environmental work. You work on trails, you just whatever. You go through the whole area. You would spend a week in camp, and then you spend a week out in the field, and a week in camp. And it was 2 summers that I did that. And through that, I was then all poised and set up to go to work and become an Outward Bound instructor in Colorado.
Oh, wow.
And I was all accepted in there, and I'd even convinced one of my friends to come with me. And I had sent out letters, the year that I was graduating, I had sent out letters of inquiry just to different school divisions,
mm-hmm.
just to say, hey, I'm graduating music ed, I'm interested in, and I'm looking for employment. What kind of job opportunities do you have? So I hadn't really applied for any jobs.
Okay.
Just letters of inquiry. And I, because of my family ties out in Winnipeg and this area, I sent some stuff to the school division in Winnipeg. And then I never followed up on any of them because I was going to Colorado. Mm. And I can remember, you know, it was in May, and I'm sitting at home, and just after I'd come back from university, getting ready to go to Colorado. A month later, and the phone rings, and a guy from Winnipeg, Don Timmerman,
okay,
just phoned me up and says, hey, I was looking through, saw your resume here, we have a job opening, thought you might be interested. I said, well, no, I'm not really, I'm going to Colorado, and this is what I'm doing. And he kept talking to me, and Don is very persuasive, but he kept talking to me, and finally I made the mistake of asking him, well, what's the starting salary?
Oh, yep.
And back then, at that time, in 1981, the starting salary for a teacher in New York State was about $9,500.
Okay.
And so I asked him what the starting salary was. And he says, oh, just a minute, let me check. And he comes back, he says, oh, yeah, it's like $18,200. And I literally pulled the phone away from me and looked at it for about 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And I put it back to my ear and I said, yeah, maybe I'm interested in that job. And that was the one question that kind of just changed my whole career path.
Yeah.
And so I flew out here and looked at the job he had out in Winnipeg, and the rest is history, as they say.
Oh, wow.
So then I had to phone up my friend and tell her, I said, you know what? I'm not going to Colorado with you. But she went, and she's still a good friend, and she worked for Outward Bound for many years, and mm-hmm. I had several other friends go out there after her. And they still all live in Colorado, and I go out and see them all the time, and some of them still work for Outward Bound. So.
Okay. Yeah, just one of those funny what-ifs, eh?
That one question changed my whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Oh, man. So whereabouts in Winnipeg did you work?
So my first year, I was teaching half-time at Sturgeon Creek.
Okay.
And half-time at Ness Junior High.
Okay.
And the following year, both programs went from being half-time to full-time. Mm. They both went that way. And so I had my choice. I could stay at the junior high or go to the high school. And I went to the high school and taught there. And my first summer after teaching, I didn't do anything. I just took the summer off. And then the second summer after teaching, which would be in the 1983, I think, I started taking just some courses here at BU.
Okay.
Towards my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I just to do something rather than do nothing in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take some summer courses. And I think I took a course with Bill Gordon, and I took a course with Wayne Bowman. And just the people, there was a group of seven or eight of us that summer that started our master's or were taking master's courses. And we just had a great time that summer.
Okay.
We worked hard, but we had some parties too.
Yep.
And then the following summer, I did the same thing. And then then it was 81, 82, 83. Then in the fall of 84, I took a year off. I just took a sabbatical from school or a leave of absence and came and did my master's full time here.
Okay. Because before that, were you driving from in and out from Winnipeg all day?
No, I was just coming for the summer.
Okay.
I would come here for the summer and I have a cousin. I would stay with a cousin and just stay here and do my master's for a couple of summers and then spend another year doing it full time.
Okay. And you decided just to do your master's at Brandon just because of the closeness?
Just because of the closeness, yeah.
Okay.
It always had a good reputation and it was close. And Brandon, I knew Brandon because I'd spent lots of summers here as a little kid.
Oh, yeah.
Visiting relatives. And so I knew Brandon and it was close. And my grandmother was still alive at the time and she lived in Elkhorn, so it was close to her too.
Oh, right.
So that's it. And then I came here and after I finished my year of school doing my master's, a job came open at Vincent Massey High School.
Mm-hmm.
It was a full-time job for choir and band. And I had done choir when I was at Sturgeon Creek, but I wasn't that good at it.
Okay.
It wasn't my strong suit. So I went to interview for the job. And plus the choir director there the year before had been Derek Morphy. And Derek Morphy is like one of the best choir teachers.
Okay.
Good directors. And sort of, you can't win if you follow somebody like that.
Yeah, pretty big shoes.
So I went into the interview and I told him, I said, you know, I'm here to interview, but basically I'm not interested in the choir part. I just am interested in the band part. Mm. And they hired me half time to teach band, which was great because then I thought, oh, I'll finish up my master's with my other half time, which never really happened. I didn't finish my master's for another, I don't know, 4 years. But that's how I got my foot in the door and taught halftime the first year, and then I think after that I was full-time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've been doing that ever since?
Been doing that ever since. I've been at Vincent Massey School since 1985 is the year I started there.
85, so 30 years.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And now I'm in my last week there now. I'm retiring.
Yeah, so I'm sure there's a lot of sad faces.
Yeah, there are, but not on my part. I'm ready to go.
Okay.
30 years is a long time.
Oh, I can imagine. So imagine, like, you know, teaching for that long, you've probably seen quite a few changes over the years in terms of just approaches to teaching and just even from how students approach music too, possibly.
Yes and no. I know really in the last 4 or 5 years, the technology is really becoming prevalent in the classroom. You know, iPads, recordings, smart boards, all that stuff. We just did a workshop yesterday with the Westman band directors on Google Docs and Google Classroom and stuff. But really, teaching band hasn't really changed that much.
Okay.
I mean, you still have to. I mean, it's like playing the piano. Really, to learn to play the piano, you have to put in the time, and you have to do your scales, and you have to. It really hasn't changed that much. What kids have changed a lot.
Okay.
I mean, instant technology, instant communication, all that stuff. I think the number of kids that are willing to put in the time and to be successful has diminished. Now, there are still lots of kids that do that.
Okay.
But overall, the quality of student in the band program, I think, has dropped a little bit just in terms of, well, there's just so much more out there for them to take. There's so many more courses than 30 years ago when they started.
Okay.
There's all these AP courses, IB courses, those all these special courses. There's more demand on kids to have jobs. They're more socially, what can I say, interactive. So it has changed a little bit, but actually teaching band, I don't think has changed that much.
Okay, so it's just been more of a focus issue than anything else.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So I guess that actually leads me, because not only have you been teaching, well, actually, maybe I shouldn't presume that, but I understand you also own the Brandon School of Dance, too.
Yes, I do.
So do you do any teaching there as well? Or?
No.
No?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I know very little about dance.
Okay.
The way that came about, my daughter, well, the Brandon School of Dance, it was owned by Barbara Ennis.
Okay.
Who was the wife of Alan Ennis, the trumpet prof here. Now, there are three dance studios in town. Two of them are much bigger, and Barbara had a very small studio.
Mm-hmm.
But she wanted it small. Her focus was on producing high-end ballet dancers or high-end dancers who just excelled at it. And she was very tough, and she had a very small studio, and my daughter would come home crying, Mrs. Ennis hates me. I know. I said, well, don't go back. Quit. No, I want to go back. So she demanded a lot, and so the quality and the product was really exceptional, way better than anything in town. And then when Alan retired and they were moving to Florida, she had a person teaching with her, Kelly Lombard, and everybody thought Kelly Lombard would take over the school.
Okay.
And it was in, it really was basically one studio up above a building downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And Kelly said, I don't want to take over this business. My family runs other businesses and I don't want another one. So yeah, I'm not gonna take over the business. So one day, just kind of out of the blue, I said, well, what if you keep teaching and I'll just buy the business and run it? She said, yeah, I would do that.
Okay.
So I arranged with Barbara to take over her business for not a very big investment. But then she had been renting this studio from a friend of hers. And they just never had a lease, or
okay.
It was just kind of a handshake agreement. And over the years, it was good. And part of my arrangement to take over the business was that the rent would remain the same for the first couple of years, and just so I could see if it was going to work.
Right.
Well, then she wanted to do a lease, so she gave me a lease, and it was really totally different from our verbal agreement.
Oh, okay.
And the rent wasn't going to remain the same. Well, the rent was remaining the same, but now she was going to charge me for utilities, which were like doubling the rent, basically.
Okay.
And she argued, no, no, the rent is the same, but now you have to pay for utilities. And she had so many onerous clauses in the lease, and my lawyer said, "Don't, you can't sign this lease. It's putting yourself too much at risk." Like, so I said, well, I'm not going to sign this lease. Well, she said, okay. So then, if this was going to go on, I had to find a different place, so we quickly found another place and renovated it. And my initial investment of $10,000 was now up to over $250,000. But we built a new facility and started, and it's just been getting bigger and bigger.
Okay, and that's the place on 10th?
10th Street, 126 10th Street.
Okay.
It used to be an old bowling alley.
Okay.
And in fact, I just finished buying the building this spring.
Oh, wow.
Which is good. So it's become, yeah, it's getting bigger and bigger, which it has to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good. And now Kelly has just retired, and I have a teacher, a fabulous teacher from Winnipeg, comes out here, lives here during the weekend, then goes home on the weekend. And it's, you know, things are changing, but we've maintained the quality and still have kind of the best product in the city.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Okay. So was it something that you've ever tried to consider, is maybe trying to merge the two between like the dance school and your music teaching experiences?
Yeah, I've thought about that, but for me to start giving music lessons and to try to start like a little studio, and there's lots of other places in town that do that. We have the conservatory here. I'd be competing against the conservatory, and so I'm not really interested in going that way.
Okay.
I think I'm just going to stick to doing dance, and the main floor space, which is vacant, try to rent it out to somebody else rather than try to offer music lessons in there. The market is pretty saturated here for music lessons, and there's good quality stuff going on already.
Okay. Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. All right, so I'm thinking now, let's maybe talk about the jazz festival, actually.
Okay.
So I understand you're the second director for the festival, correct?
Yeah, kind of. There's been other people that have directed it throughout the years. The festival started, I think, in 1983.
Okay.
By Wayne Bowman, who used to be on faculty here, and a local band director named Dave Schmidt. And they just saw a need to have an educational festival for jazz, because they were both interested in jazz. And so they started it the first year, I think, with 12 groups.
Okay.
And they brought in, and it was just one day, groups came in, played for each other, played for the adjudicators. There was a little bit of a concert in the evening, maybe. And then they went home. And then the next year or the following year, I got involved because I was here doing a master's.
Mm-hmm.
And the festival started to get a little bit bigger. Maybe it went up to 20 groups. And then about the second year I was here, I took over as the director of it. Yeah, just somebody to run it. And it got bigger and bigger. And I took a year off. And another guy, I don't exactly remember the timelines, but there was a year I took off, and Sean McManus ran it for 1 year.
Okay.
And by this time it was up to like 50 or 60 groups. I thought, man, I can't get any bigger. And then I took another couple of years off in there because I was just getting burned out. And a guy named Roger Manti, who was actually a Massey grad and a BU grad, is now a professor at Arizona State University.
Okay.
He took it over and he built it up to groups into the 80s or 90s. He ran it for a couple of years, and then I came back. And I've been running it ever since, and we max out now at about 170 groups.
Okay, and whereabouts do they all come from?
We've had groups from the U.S., from Alberta, from Ontario, from Saskatchewan and Manitoba.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are they all just predominantly primary school and high school?
You know, mostly high school. I'm going to say probably 60% is high school, maybe 40% is junior high. We do have some elementary groups that come in.
Okay.
And last year we had actually a group from U of M come in.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
So, really taking off.
Yeah. The numbers have kind of leveled out because we really can't take any more groups now. We've just maxed out the facilities, maxed out the schedule.
Okay.
So we're about as big as we can get.
Okay, and if you wanted to go any further, that would probably require massive expenditures and just time involvement.
Well, yeah, bigger is better only to a point, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to get too big so you can't manage everything.
Okay.
Yeah,
that makes sense. So, with your experience working with the festival, how do you feel the general view is in regards to like the general community in regards to the festival? Like, do you feel it's a lot of really appreciated, or?
Well, I know that the business community loves the festival because of the economic impact here. You can't get a hotel room on the Thursday or Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
The restaurants and the fast food places are all jam full. The hotels love it. You can't get a bus anywhere. All the buses in Saskatchewan and Manitoba are chartered. The Shoppers Mall, I've heard them say that weekend of Jazz Festival is their biggest weekend of the year, bigger than Christmas.
Wow.
So it's a big economic impact that way for the city.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact that we get to bring in world-class jazz musicians.
Absolutely.
For the festival that normally you wouldn't be able to bring in. And the reason is because we know we're going to sell out concerts at the auditorium here with all those kids here. That's why, you know, that's a big part of the festival for them, is to come to the evening concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a built-in audience. So the community benefits that way, is that they get the chance to hear these artists that they would never stop in Brandon otherwise, or might not even stop in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good that way.
Okay. And do you feel that's just as much due to the pull or the attraction of the university itself, or is it through the festival specifically, do you feel?
I think it's the festival itself.
Okay.
Yeah, that it really is, because the university doesn't run the festival.
Right.
It's the festival is run, it's an independent, it's a charitable organization, federally registered charitable organization. Now, we, having said that, we couldn't really run the festival without the university because we use their facilities. We have the auditorium and all the students here because we have about 150 volunteers that we need to make it run.
Oh, okay.
So that's, it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, they benefit and we benefit.
Yeah.
And it really is good for the university mm-hmm. because you get kids that have been coming here to Brandon University and to the School of Music for 3 or 4 or 5 years by coming with their schools to the festival. And if they decide that they want to go into music after high school,
yeah.
they start thinking about what are their choices. Well, there's U of M or there's Brandon University. And they've been here, they've been on the campus, they're familiar with it, they know what it's like, they know what the facilities are like, they know what the programs are like. So I think it, I know it's a huge recruiting tool for the university.
Okay.
So it's good that way.
Yeah, for sure. So perhaps that's a question as well. Do you feel there's many distinctions between like the Brandon Jazz Festival as compared to say like the, I think the Winnipeg Jazz Festival is currently on right now.
Two different formats, two different philosophies.
Okay.
A lot of those big international jazz festivals, Montreal Jazz Festival, Toronto, Winnipeg Jazz Festival, their educational component is really small. They have one, but it's small. They're really bringing in big name acts for people to go and attend concerts and go to restaurants or pubs and hear them. It's more of a concert style
okay.
festival. And you don't go there and play on your own. You just go and consume. Here, we have all these groups coming in to perform, and they all perform for adjudicators and get feedback, and they go to workshops and clinics all day long.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have some concerts in the evening. And then our big-name artists, too, like Diane Scher was our artist in residence this year.
Okay.
She came in and did a workshop with the university students. And then during the festival, she'll have she'll have a couple of sessions where, you know, high school kids, junior high kids can come in and sit there and talk to her and ask her questions and interact with her.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get that in Winnipeg either, where you know the big name stars come in and they do their concerts and they're gone.
Right.
Here, the big name artists come in and they're doing their concerts, but they also come into the classroom and get to talk to the kids, and the kids get to talk to them, and they get to interact that way. So it's a different philosophy and it's a different kind of festival.
Okay, it's almost geared towards more the just getting exposure for the students more than
it's an educational thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So he had mentioned before that just in terms of because it's a fairly small campus and everything, like you're basically maxed out for size. Have there been many other challenges that you guys have faced over the years in developing the festival? Or
challenges, just meeting budget every year, you know, keeping it affordable. Like we're very reasonably priced, and really we look to break even
okay.
and bring in the biggest names that we can with the budget that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a pretty good job of that.
Okay.
Challenges. No, I can't say that there's really. Well, one challenge that it's not so much now, but even 6 or 7 years ago, we would, like we come in on a Wednesday night and basically take over every room in the School of Music, mm-hmm. except for the teacher's offices and stuff, but we take over all the classrooms and all the rehearsal halls, all day Thursday, all day Friday, and all day Saturday. Well, that means classes either have to be canceled or moved out, and
right.
and we actually still do have some pushback from some of the teachers saying, "Oh no, I need to have my rehearsal. You can't, you know, I can't cancel it, and
right.
you can't have the room." And I have to say, "Well, you just have to talk to the dean because he's given us the room, and you know, if you have a problem with that, go and talk to him."
Yeah, precisely.
But and the other thing that's a little frustrating is. We bring in all these students here. We bring in about 4,000 students,
mm-hmm.
potential students to come here.
Right.
But a lot of the faculty just, the jazz festival's here. I'm getting out of here.
Oh, yeah.
And so they don't come out and interact with the students. They don't go up to them afterwards and say, hey, I heard your performance. You know, have you ever thought about coming here? There's very little of that. So that's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
It's like, and that's kind of, that's kind of the mentality that's a difference between the U.S. and here.
Okay.
Right? Down in the U.S., if you're teaching at a university or a college, you have to recruit. And recruiting is a big part of going out and getting your students and finding them and getting them to come to your studio. Up here, it's more of a, oh, if we build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they've got this nice facility, and they don't feel that recruiting is part of their mandate or their job or anything. It's not their job.
Okay. From what I understand, most of the U.S. schools, they're all privately funded, correct?
No.
No?
No, a lot of them are, but the state universities are not.
Okay.
But it's just a different, it's just a different mindset.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I guess I definitely know what you mean about kind of like the campus apathy towards it, because I used to live in residence for 3 years, and anytime Jazz Fest was on, like, you're, you know, good luck trying to get any food at the cafeteria, but I do agree with you. It should be something that, you know, it should be, yeah, like, the community should kind of get behind it at least. But
it's the biggest open house the university has, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's geared toward music, it's like, well, why doesn't the science department offer science tours? Say, hey, come on, if you're interested in science, come and see what we have here.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot that could be done, but...
Yeah, like, you know, maybe provide a lecture on the, you know, physics of acoustics or something like that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Those are all things that I don't think about. I got enough just to run the festival.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. And so you mentioned, in terms of the performers that you guys bring in, how did that start, just bringing in all these big name acts? Like, was it kind of a serendipity, or was it just active pursuit?
Yeah, active pursuit. I used to be on the international board of a organization that is now defunct, but it was called International Association of Jazz Educators.
Okay.
And I would go to the conferences every year. And at these conferences, Tony Bennett's at them, Arturo Sandoval, all these huge names. And it's kind of the same thing. You're riding the elevator with Herbie Hancock, or you're just interacting and talking to all these big names. Artists and educators, and through going to that, I got to know a whole network of people, and I got to the point where I'm not afraid to phone up anybody and say, hey, what's the possibility of you coming up here to do the Jazz Festival, and to you know, this is what it's about. Explain to them what it's about. And sometimes we can't afford them. You know, I phoned up Mel Torme's manager just to find out from him one time. And we talked for a while, nice guy, and he says, well, how big is your hall? And I told him, it seats 800. He says, you know, it's not big enough, because Mel's fee is this, and you can't afford to make it. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But we talked, and, there's nobody that I won't phone just to find out. And a lot of people do come. You know, we've had Tuck and Patty, we've had Rob McConnell, we've had lots of great jazz players from Canada. We just had Diane Schur, you know, one of the biggest vocalists in jazz today.
Yeah.
And she was wonderful when she came here. She had a great time with the kids. I sat and we would talk for an hour, and she would talk to the kids, and it was great. She had a great time here.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, it's just matter of getting over the fear of hearing no from people, basically.
I've heard that lots. and mostly it's not like, oh no, I'm not into that. I don't, you know, they're not crusty about it. It's like, well, either it doesn't fit their schedule, or no, we can't afford to bring them in, or whatever. But yeah.
Okay. So in terms of just like festivals in general around community, I Off the top of my head, I really can't think of too many. I think Jazz Festival and Folk Festival. Those are the two that immediately come to mind for Brandon. Like, do you feel there's much of a festival sort of atmosphere to the city? Or?
Well, there's the Egg Red competition.
Okay.
There's Folk Festival, Jazz Festival. There's the Lieutenant Governor's Winter Festival.
Of course.
What else is there? There are some other things that are, like, I know that ACC has their Gray Owl, mm-hmm. which is like a culinary festival of sorts.
Right.
You know, there's lots going on in this community in terms of, it doesn't always have to be about the festivals and the arts. I mean, we have the art gallery, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
We have, but there's lots of sports things going on. There's lots of... There's lots going on in a city this size.
Okay.
So, there's lots to do here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of that is the university and the School of Music. Like, we have, well, they have a pro series. We have the symphony come in.
Right.
We have the ballet come in.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a nice facility and a nice concert hall. We have the university, which brings in a lot of performers and a lot of concerts that way. We have some community choirs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on here.
Okay.
For a city this size.
Okay, so, and that, I guess that's not something I have much experience with. So, is it simply a matter of, so I guess size doesn't necessarily dictate what's available, per se. It's just kind of what the people in the community are willing to do.
Yeah, it's that, plus the university, you know, brings an element to the city, mm-hmm. in terms of the culture and the things that it offers here.
Yeah.
I think Brandon's just the right size.
Okay.
It's there is lots going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, in terms of just overall, I guess maybe jazz, maybe saturation in the community. Do you get a sense that jazz is really well appreciated outside of the university, or still fairly?
Oh yeah, there's a very small core group of people here that will support jazz, and you know, not only through the jazz festival, but for the high school, we would bring in artists too, and we would mm-hmm. go and perform either. Sometimes we book the Lauren Watson, or we'll go down to a little place called the Music Studio,
mm-hmm.
down at 10th and Rosser. And that seats about 200. And so we'll bring in artists there, and they'll bring in artists. Somebody has to sponsor them to come in.
Right.
But we'll have some good jazz concerts down there. Is it saturated? No, I don't think it's saturated. I mean, the festival is unique in that it happens for one weekend out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, really, if you look at Montreal, or you look at Toronto, or you look at Winnipeg or Vancouver, they have their big jazz festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And for 10 days or 2 weeks or however long their festival runs, they're saturated with jazz. The city is jazz crazy.
Right.
But then for the rest of the year, it can be tough to go out and hear good live jazz.
Okay.
So then the market shrinks again, like, tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's tough to be a professional jazz musician in those cities, I think. I think the market is very small and very select.
Okay.
So it's kind of weird that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have the same thing here. Yeah, jazz for one weekend and then for the rest of the year. But there's, I mean, the kids from the university here, which is mainly who is playing, if you're not bringing somebody else in, they'll go down and they'll play gigs down. And, well, they'll play at Suds, or they'll play at the Decker, or
right.
other little gigs around town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you do feel that there is enough interest to actually keep, like, a large, like, jazz program at the university here fairly active then?
If there wasn't, it wouldn't be here.
That's very true too.
You know, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, because the jazz program itself at the university, it's still relatively new in terms of the school. Like, it's back in the 70s, I believe.
Well, they were having a jazz band here late 70s for sure.
Okay.
But It hasn't really started to really take off, I would say, except in the last 10 years.
Okay.
And before that, they would have a jazz band, but they'd have no jazz ped courses.
Okay.
So I can remember I would be getting student teachers, like almost every high school in the province, if you're teaching band, has a jazz band, and most of the junior highs.
Okay.
So that's part of when you get a band job, you have to be able to teach concert band and jazz band.
Mm-hmm.
But yet they had no teacher training for jazz. And it got frustrating for me to one point where I said, well, I'll take student teacher, but only if they have jazz experience.
Okay.
Because I would be getting student teachers with no jazz experience.
Right.
And my argument was always that they're going to have to teach that when they get out into their program, when they get a job. Why aren't you teaching them how to teach that?
Mm-hmm.
So I just said, don't give me a student unless they have jazz experience, and not just playing a jazz band, but some other thing. So then they would start offering jazz history course. And then it really started when Greg Gation came here.
Okay.
That they started to take jazz a little more seriously, I guess, or develop more of the curriculum for jazz ped and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and offer more. And you're right, the jazz program has flourished in the last 10 years here. Now they have, what, 3 full-time faculty for jazz: Eric Platts on drums and Michael Kane on piano and Greg Gation. And it's been very successful. Probably the most successful program in the School of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because kids like jazz and they're getting a good education in it here. Yeah. And I think they go out and they promote the program very well.
All right.
I think that's important.
Okay. So in terms of teaching, what do you feel are like some of the biggest differences between teaching jazz band versus teaching a more classical oriented maybe band?
Well, the differences are just the style of music and the things that you do in jazz band. There's a lot of improvisation.
Okay.
And it's just a style. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you're teaching the kid how to play their instrument and how to play in a certain style. And it's really not that much different from teaching concert band.
Okay.
Okay. The foundations and the fundamentals of learning to play your instrument are the same.
Mm-hmm.
You're just learning to play in a different style.
Yeah, I guess from the unfortunate little that I do understand of jazz, it's a lot more of a, like, time signatures. There's quite a difference sometimes with that, or am I completely out in left field with that?
You're out in left field with that.
Okay. All right, fair enough.
Time is time, whether you're playing classical music or jazz music.
Oh, okay.
There's lots of classical music that is in odd meter.
Okay.
I don't think there's a difference there at all. It is different in terms of classical music is everything is pretty much written. Well, no, that's not even true. For a lot of music, classical music, it's all written down, right?
Yeah.
Play what's on the page. But not for a lot of the modern music. A lot of modern music is very interpretive, and it's different all the time.
Okay.
But it's not jazz, right? It's and jazz brings some different things to it that are unique to jazz. There's a lot of improvisation. And then again, back in the time of Bach and everything, they would have to improvise when they're playing the organ and playing their, you know, they'd have the bass figures, but then they'd do a lot of improvising.
Okay.
So maybe it's not all that different.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, because there's a lot of interaction between the musicians. There's some ground rules. There's some structure to it. I mean, there's lots of structure to it, but there's a lot of freedom within it to do your own thing and to create. It's just different.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you for that lesson.
See, the thing about jazz, and it's in a lot of ways it's its own worst enemy, because it is, a lot of times the musicians are playing for themselves, they're not playing for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like Wynton Marsalis says this, too. He says, you know, jazz is its own worst enemy. Nobody wants to go and listen to some guy playing this wicked out there solo for 8 or 10 minutes that, you know, is so technical and so far out. He says it just doesn't connect with most people. Even myself, as listening to jazz, there's a lot of jazz that I don't want to listen to because it's like, wow, that guy's just like, I don't want to listen to what he's playing.
Okay.
And so it's a bit of a turnoff. But, I mean, yeah, there's lots of structure and to keep, it's just understanding what it's all about.
Okay.
And once you understand it and know what they're doing and what's going on, you learn to appreciate it more. But a lot of people never get that information.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned as well, like quite often with jazz performers, they do have to do a lot of moving around and to play with different venues, like you mentioned. Some places, you know, they play 2 weeks and then they have to kind of go off to find other venues. Does that create a pretty close kind of like community among jazz, like aficionados and performers as well, just like across the board? Or does it kind of create pockets of jazz throughout?
Well, there is a jazz community. Like, a lot of players know each other across the country, especially here.
Okay.
And it's tough to get a steady gig as a jazz musician. So you're always, like, you know, most musicians are, especially jazz musicians, they'll be in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 different groups,
mm-hmm.
playing different styles and with different instrumentation, and so you have to be able to play a lot of styles, and you know, not just jazz but other things too, because you got to pay the bills. So if somebody calls you up and say, "Hey, I've got a polka gig for a bass player. Do you want to play?"
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's gonna say, "Oh no, I'm a jazz musician." You take the gig,
yeah.
and you play it. There is a real jazz community within cities, within centers, and then from centers to centers too. Like, we know now that if a group is touring, or groups are touring across the country, and say they're playing a gig in Winnipeg and then their next gig is in Saskatoon or Regina,
mm-hmm.
they'll say, "Hey, Brandon, I know that I have a lot of friends that have played jazz gigs in Brandon, and maybe it doesn't pay great
because mm-hmm.
the venue is small, but I have the option of making nothing on my off night, or making something on my off night, and or even just playing."
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they'll take, you know, they'll come here and they'll find a small venue. We have our small venue, and they'll play, and there'll be a nice crowd, and we'll treat them nice and give them a nice dinner, and
mm-hmm.
and they like to come back here, even though it doesn't pay great. They're like, it was a nice place.
Yeah, good.
So you know, word of mouth does get around.
Yeah.
But like, we get a lot of people. I get a lot of emails, people saying, "Hey, I'm coming through. I'd like to stop and play there."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just about to say too. Like, especially with, in terms of like social network sites and everything, I probably speed or helps things out quite a bit there too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Okay. All right. So I'm thinking maybe we'll kind of get into a little more, perhaps general questions.
Okay.
So I think we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but for general overall sense, how important do you think music is to a community?
Well, I think music is important in society just in general.
Okay.
And in any community. I'm looking up behind you there. It says life would be B flat without music.
Yeah.
You know, music is in every culture, whether it's the kind of music that we understand or if it's, I mean, different cultures have different styles of music. But music is just, it's important to every culture. It's used in rituals, and when I talk about rituals, I'm talking about marriages, parties, all kinds of things, funerals, religious services.
Mm-hmm.
It's is just a big part of what we do. Can you imagine? Can you imagine going to watching a movie and there's no background music?
Yeah.
Or a TV show, no background music. Mm-hmm. Or going to a funeral or a wedding and no music at all.
Yeah.
I mean, look at people walking around the campus. You know, so many of them have their headphones on. What are they doing? Are they listening to talk shows? No, they're listening to music.
Yeah.
So, you know, music is a part of our fabric, and it is. It's just important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially when there's so many different styles too, it's kind of interesting to see what kind of sticks in certain areas as well.
Oh yeah, and now with everything is like, oh, you want this? Oh, just go on YouTube, listen to this.
Yeah.
You want to get this? Oh, just download it off iTunes.
Yeah.
You know, these kids at school where I teach, they're listening to groups, and I'll often say to them, what kind of music do you listen to? And they're naming these groups that I have no clue what they're talking about. I've never heard of them. And they're talking about all these different styles of music, and I'm like, I have no idea what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a real Luddite in that sense, in that I, you know, I know what I like to listen to, and I don't listen to a lot of the stuff unless kids say, here, listen to this. And but...
Yeah, especially with, you know, YouTube as well. So if you do want to list off something that's a little older, more influential, say like something like King Crimson or something like that, you throw that on to somebody and they go and watch, it's like, oh, wow.
It's true. That, I mean, that's one way technology has really benefited. If we're in, say, in rehearsal, a jazz band rehearsal, and I'll say, just give me a second, and in 30 seconds I can have a James Brown clip up on the board, and we're watching it, and the kids are like, wow, look at that, that's crazy, and... So, yeah, you can... That's one good thing about technology is you can access anything, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to listen to a recording of this tune by the original artist, you can find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes the grainy footage and all.
Yep.
So another thing we'd also mentioned as well, like in terms of just the festivals and what they provide for the city, do you get an impression that city, more specifically maybe City Hall, do you feel they try to have a close ties with the music community in Brandon as well?
I don't get a sense of that. I don't think that's their mandate. They're supportive of the Jazz Festival. They give us a grant every year, but they give grants out to a lot of cultural groups.
Mm-hmm.
That's government. And how much should government... And at what level should they get involved?
Okay.
You know, the provincial government has a lot of grant programs for music, but you have to apply for them. And,
yeah.
So I'm not going to say the City Hall is not supportive, because anything, you know, they are supportive.
Mm-hmm.
But is it really part of their mandate to do that? Maybe not.
Okay.
You know, let them deal with their core competencies, mm-hmm. and let other people deal with their core competencies. You know, our job is to, our core competency for the Jazz Festival is to run a jazz festival.
Right.
Do I want City Hall to really get involved?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. Do I want them to give me money? Yes. So we can do it, yeah, but do I want them involved in the planning and the, you know, all that? No. Right.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But from what I understand, that's kind of been a trend, not so much with this cities per se, but just with governments in general, because especially like 70s and 80s, a lot of these organizations and festivals that did start up, a lot of it was heavily dependent upon government funding. But then as soon as the 90s came around, that funding started drying up, and a lot of these community organizations started drying up too. But
funding is always a problem for the arts, not just music, but for, you know, any of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question is, well, in Canada, do we support the arts enough?
Okay.
Well, compared to a lot of other countries and in Europe and stuff, no, we don't. The amount that we put towards the arts is a fraction of what they get supported, like in Germany and stuff like that.
Okay.
But I think the current federal government, they're doing that across the board to everything.
Right.
They're slashing scientific research, they're slashing this and this, and that's just part of what they see as their mandate is the fiscal responsibility. You know, it's conservative government.
Yeah, precisely.
Let's make government smaller and less funding. And whereas if the NDP came in, they would probably increase that funding. But I don't know. I know with our jazz festival here, I try to rely as little as possible on government funding.
Okay.
We have one major funder from the provincial government, but federal government, I don't apply for anything from there.
Okay.
Their application forms and all of that just got to be not worth the time it was to fill it out to get the money that I was going to get from them.
Yeah.
So I could be more active that way.
Okay. Yeah.
But we get by. We get by.
Yeah, because I think on the website, I think you said, I think it even mentioned in there stating that a lot of their money does come from the groups that do come in and everything.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
And I guess another aspect of the funding too, in terms of school divisions, I think you kind of implied that the school divisions kind of, they pretty readily accepted having jazz programs through the school as well. So I guess in terms of school funding, is that something that was always...
You know, in Manitoba especially, and in Brandon, the funding for the school programs and the band programs is usually pretty good.
Okay.
In Brandon, it's especially good. We have a very strong parents organization. Like,
okay.
They just approved to spend $60,000 for new instruments.
Wow.
But that's a little higher than normal. But in the average year, they spend about $45,000 on new instruments.
Okay.
That's the parents group, not the school. But the school does fund pretty well, too.
Okay. But it's predominantly an outside effort.
Yeah, it's a kind of a combination.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the school division pays for the facilities, they pay for the teachers' salaries, they pay for the busing to move the kids around that need to be bused.
Mm-hmm.
But the parents group is a strong part of it, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, kind of blanking at the moment. So maybe to change gears a bit, have you noticed if there's been any differences in just kind of in overall terms of how performances are done nowadays? Like, do you get the impression that you kind of have to sink more money into performances, or can you still kind of do things on a shoestring budget, or like are venues changing?
Now, performances for who, though?
There is that. So I guess maybe we can look at it from both ways. So in terms from the performer's perspective and maybe from an audience perspective, like, have there been any differences that you've noticed?
But who's performing? Are you talking about school groups? Or are you talking about professional groups? What?
Okay. I would assume in terms of school groups, the performances have probably more or less stayed the same.
Yeah, exactly. High school band concert hasn't really changed that much.
Right.
For our jazz band concert, hasn't really changed that much. You go out, you find a good venue, and we've done some of our concerts in the park. We usually try to go to a cafe or something, do something where the people can eat and drink, and for that, to make it more of a kind of a realistic setting.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think has really changed that much. For live bands and stuff, yeah, I'm sure it has. You got to come in now with, well, look at the big name acts. It's all video, and there's big screen TVs,
right,
and it's all projectors. And but you know, I'm not really involved in that aspect of it too much.
Okay.
So I don't really know. I don't go to a lot of concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the jazz festival, for Winnipeg Jazz Festival, I really will. Don't like to go. I guess I got spoiled going to this jazz conference I used to belong to, because I could go into very small venues and hear these great musicians play all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to go to a big concert, like I went to Michael Bublé a couple of years ago at the MTS Center.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're there with, you know, 15,000 other people, and you're sitting up way up, and you don't really have that interaction or that closeness. So I don't like going to concerts like that.
Okay, you just kind of like they keep things fairly close and intimate.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Now you mentioned like being member, like part of organizations there, thing. Are there still quite a few? Like, are they predominantly international organizations, or are they fairly? But there seem to be quite a few regional and national level organizations.
You know, it just depends on the group. And for the jazz thing, I was involved in an international one.
Okay.
So I was on that board for a while. And then I got involved with the national one and was the executive director for that for a while. And that was for jazz. For band directors, there's a national organization, which is not really that, doesn't do a lot of stuff. You belong to it, but it's not active on a national level.
Okay.
Then there's a provincial level, and it's very active. And they do a lot of stuff and a lot of programs. So our provincial organization is very strong. And then just there's different regions within the province.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a workshop yesterday with the Westman directors.
Okay.
From the whole Westman area. And it's very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And at each level, no matter what organization it is, but at each level, it depends on people that are in the leadership roles.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do. Provincially, we have a very strong organization because the people that are on the provincial executive make it strong. Nationally, it's harder and it's not as active.
Mm-hmm.
Locally, with the Westman Group, very strong. We have a real sense of family. We get together, we have functions, we do professional development.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's some people that organize it and you know, make it strong like that, so it just depends on your leadership and your people in charge and what's going to happen.
Okay, so it's as much a personal drive as it is just sort of a social push.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it's that way with any organization.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It doesn't have to be in music. It can be in anything.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's the dentists or maybe it's, you know, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same way.
Yeah.
If the organizers and the people that are running it are strong and active, then usually the organization is active and strong.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've actually covered all the questions I've got down here. Was there anything that you would like to elaborate on, or anything else that you would maybe think to mention?
No, I can't really think of anything.
No. All right. Well, Mr. Campbell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.